Since this is the fourth Sunday of Easter and Good Shepherd Sunday, in common parlance, you get one portion of John 10 every year. This is the last portion, really, the 11 through 18. By way of introduction, Leon Morris reminds us that this is the last public address of Jesus that John records. So in the story as John is telling it, this is an important and sort of final moment for Jesus to tell the world at large who he is. And to do that, he uses the figure of a good shepherd. There's way too much literature on imagery of shepherd to try to cover it here. But the book we use it here on campus by Craig Kester on symbolism in John has a nice section on shepherd as well. In terms of Old Testament background, most people point us to passages like Ezekiel 34 or Zechariah 11 as better background for this than Psalm 23, but as I was listening to my colleague here, I think there are a couple of important points of contact, especially in terms of the phrase, my life, which in the Septuagint shows up as tein psychein mou, which will feature prominently here in just a moment, and also the for the sake of your name, which is an important theme throughout John's Gospel. Raymond Brown divides this opening section of John 10 into three little parables, and I think that's helpful. If you've ever read straight through this and tried to say, okay, Jesus is this, no, wait a minute, Jesus is that, suddenly it gets very confused. Is he the door? Is he the shepherd? What is he? And I think that's a helpful suggestion. Then this would be, let me just read how he explains it. The first parable in verses 1 to 3 concerns the way to approach the sheep. Therefore, its explanation concerns the gate. The second parable concerns the relation between shepherd and sheep. Therefore, its explanation concerns the shepherd. We have two interpretations of I am the gate, each with a slightly different nuance. So we have two interpretations of I am the good or model shepherd, each with its own nuance. This would be then the section interpreting what Jesus means when he says, I am the good shepherd. And then 17 and 18, he says, seem to lie somewhat outside the picture of the parable and its explanation. It also struck me as I was listening to Professor Egger that it seems ultimately the metaphor is inadequate to finally say everything that needs to be said. I mean, God is like a shepherd, but ultimately, I mean, we don't walk like sheep into the valley, right? Sheep wouldn't even know they were in the valley of the shadow of death. So there he has to come back to human language. And here, too, in the closing verses then of this gospel, shepherd and sheep imagery is left completely behind. And we're talking then about just life and death itself. Okay, well, let's then get into the text. As is typical with John, this isn't too difficult to translate, but it sure is challenging to understand and explain. So, okay, starting at verse 11, Ego eimi ha poimein ha kalos. Simple enough, a summer Greek student could translate this, I am the shepherd, the good one. But all of those words, especially if we think of ego, eimi as a phrase, could and in fact have inspired pages and pages of commentary. We won't rehearse all of the discussion of I am statements in John. But again, if you want to review that, Raymond Brown in the first volume of his Anchor Bible Commentary gives a nice rehearsal of the statement when it appears by itself and when it has a predicate with it, and looks at Old Testament connections and even connections outside of the canon. In terms of what exactly is being said here, the shepherd, I think we're already thinking shepherds now that we've read through Psalm 23 again and the whole history of king and priestly, from humble to great, from good to wicked that you see in the Old Testament. But Jesus says he is the kolos poimen. And good is probably not adequate, although in the end I think it's still the best translation. But here is one place you'll want to try to help people understand what does Jesus mean by good. Again, Brown emphasizes sort of model. He's the perfect shepherd. Carson emphasizes more the idea of noble in the sense that he acts always out of the interest of the sheep, never out of self-interest. And you see both those ideas coming into play in what follows. Okay, in fact, our Lord himself goes on to define what he means in the second half of the verse. Ha poimen ha kolos tein psychein autu tithesin hyperton probaton. So the good shepherd, then you see subject, then object, tein psychein autu, his life, and then verb, places or lays down, and then hyper for the sake of the sheep. This phrase of using tithemi with psychein is really uniquely Johannine. You see it in John and in 1 John, but it's not Old Testament language, and no one has been able to trace any other literary source even outside the Old Testament. So it seems to be very specific here, and Barrett points out this is really crucifixion language. Okay. Then continuing now with verse 12. Ha mizthotos kai uk on poimen. Mizthotos, from the verb mispao, to hire, is the hired one. In our New Testament literature, we only see this as a substantive for a hired man, hired worker. And so the contrast then is the hired worker. Kaiuk, so also is not, or is not even the shepherd. And here you have uk with a participle, which seems a little unusual, but Barrett says the proper negative for a statement of downright fact is ooh. So it's just sort of plain and simple. He is not the shepherd. Where do you see chiefly the difference? Hu uk estin ta probata idia. Sort of word by word, whose are not the sheep his own. So the difference between the hired man and the true shepherd is that the sheep don't belong to the hired man. He doesn't look at them as his own. Okay, theore ton lukon erkomenon. From theoreo, he sees. And here you have an accusative object, the wolf, and then a participle that modifies wolf. This is common with verbs of seeing and hearing. You see someone doing something. So he sees the wolf coming, and he, that is now the hired man, af iezen ton probata. He leaves the sheep, really in the sense of sort of deserting them, leaving them on their own. And fuge, he flees. And kai ha lukos harpadze auta kai skorpidze. And the wolf then snatches them and scatters them. And some commentators have noticed how those two actions don't seem to go together. But if you're trying to describe what a wolf does to a group of sheep, I don't know how else you would describe it. He grabs what he can and the others flee. To what? There is no safety where they're fleeing. Okay, and then the reason for all of this is in verse 13, Hati misthotos estin kai u mele auto periton probaton. Because he is a hired man. And u mele auto, sort of again, if you look at the grammar, it's something like there is no care to him. He doesn't have any concern, peri, for the sheep. And again, if all of this has been building to a contrast between the hireling and the true shepherd, then the opposite must be true of the shepherd, that he does care for the sheep and then won't act in this way. I suppose in a sense, you could, if you really back up for the big picture, you can see here another parallel or connection with Psalm 23, that we're not simply talking about provision, but we're actually talking about what happens when you face the ultimate enemy, when you are in that death shadow. The hireling flees and leaves you to the death shadow, or here we could paraphrase and say the death wolf, who seizes you. But now this is what the good shepherd does. Ego eimi, again repeating that very divine sounding statement, I am the good shepherd, and ginosko ta ema, I know my own. Notice the emas, or ema is the form of emas, which is really like a possessive adjective, where instead of the genitive it takes the gender number in case of the noun it's modifying. Here going back to probata. Kai ginosku si me ta ema, and my own know me. Here, if there is any doubt that we're thinking of covenant language of knowing, beyond just recognizing, well, actually the next verse even transcends that, where you get the kathos, just as, that is, our relationship of mutual knowing is the same as ginoske me ha pater, just as the Father knows me, kago, again the the combining together of kai and ego. Usually, or not at least often, with a kind of correlative force, that is, an I for my part, he does something, and I, on the other hand, I know the Father. There's a nice little word of explanation in the book by Kelly and Maloney on the Gospel of John, that the bond between the Good Shepherd and his own finds its source and exemplar in the mutuality existing between the Father and the Son. I won't read the rest of it, but I refer you to that as a for some nice reflections on the full force of that statement. Okay. Now again, we return to this idea, which doesn't naturally, I think, follow from the idea of being a good shepherd. Kai tein psychein mu tithemi hyperton probaton. I lay down my life for the sheep. You might think a good shepherd would risk his life for the sheep, but the question arises, how can this be good for the sheep if the shepherd dies? Aren't they then simply exposed to all the danger that was there in the first place? We'll come back to that. But as we said before, Jesus will have to leave behind the shepherd parable to really address that question. Kai Allah probata echo. So this is not the Allah, the conjunction, but Allah from Allahs, other. And other sheep I have, ha, the relative pronoun referring back to these sheep, who are not estin ektes aules tautes, who are not part of this fold, this sort of enclosure. Kakena, here you get kai and ekena joined together. So, and these, now the syntax here is a little bit complicated, but if you start with day and then ask what do you expect when you have day, then the rest of it sort of falls into place. So you usually expect an infinitive with an accusative subject. So you have, it is necessary to lead. That's the agagein from ago, and with me as the subject. So it's necessary for me to lead or bring. And then with ago, you would have an accusative object, and that's the kai ekena, which is put forward for emphasis. And these sheep, it is necessary for me to bring, that is here. And tais phonesmu akousousin, and they will hear my voice. Again, this harkens back to earlier in John 10, where his sheep know him. This is the sign that they know him. They hear his voice, rather than the voice of a stranger. Kai geneson tai mia poimne heis poimne. You can see there's some discussion on the number of the verb here, well, some difference among the texts. Nestle all in 27 has the third person plural, and they will be one herd or flock of sheep and one shepherd, without a kai in there. If it's singular, you just get there will be. That is the resulting state. If it's plural, as it is here, then the many sheep or the sheep that he brings all together will be one herd or flock and one shepherd. Raymond Brown does a nice job trying to preserve the similarity in sound there between poimne and poimain. He says it will be one sheep herd, one shepherd. And that's the closeness you see in the Greek. Okay, then as we leave behind these shepherd and sheep parables, Jesus speaks much more directly. Remember, this is John 10, so this is before the lengthy discourse to his own disciples that immediately precedes his death. Dia tuta, on account of this, or for this reason, me hopater agapa. When the object comes first, you can almost translate it, it's, I am the one that the Father loves, putting the emphasis on the object here. And why hoti? Because ego tithemi tem psikein mu. I lay down my life, hina palin labo autain. Raymond Brown has a sort of very strong discussion here that hina cannot be anything other than a purpose statement here. And he says people are uneasy that Jesus would lay down his life with the purpose to take it up again. But he says this is the message of John's gospel. The passion, the death, and the resurrection, the ascension, they constitute one saving act that can't be broken apart. So this Jesus views this as one thing, laying down his life and taking it up. This will not end in death. And he knows that already from the beginning. And he makes this even stronger in verse 18. Udes aire autain ap emu. No one takes it, autain, that is, my life, from me, takes it away from me, apa emu. All, on the other hand, or on the contrary, ego tithemi autain ap emu. And if the sort of intention, the willingness in tithemi isn't plain, then you get the op emu of myself, of my own accord. I lay it down, you might say voluntarily, almost freely, without compulsion, by my decision. Exousian echo thenai autain. Now, normally we translate exousia with authority. I have authority. Thenai is the aorist infinitive for tithemi, to place it or to lay it down. Kai exousian echo palin labain autain. And authority I have again, labain from lambano, to take it again. Brown, again, suggests maybe authority is the wrong point here, and power is probably the idea. It just means I can do this. It's not, I've been given the go-ahead or the okay, but I have this within my control to do this. I have power to lay it down, and I have power to take it up again. Tau tain tain en to lein elaban. This command, leave it at command for now. Elaban para tu patras mu. I received, aorist again from Lambano, from my father. Brown equates command of the Father with his will. This is the will of the Father. This is the mission of the Son, and he willingly obeys the Father's will. Again, it's a well-known passage, perhaps not as frequently quoted and put on greeting cards as Psalm 23. But what can we say about this again this year? I've often thought it's helpful in these weeks, these Sundays of Easter, to think back to the situation of the original disciples who are, in light of the resurrection of Jesus, reflecting back on the things he had taught them before. And certainly for this passage, it sounds very different now that we're in Easter than it did if we were, for instance, reading this in Lent. So everything Jesus has said about his own power and authority has been vindicated and demonstrated clearly that he wasn't exaggerating, that he did lay down his life and that he took it up again. And so he is not the good and dead shepherd, but the good shepherd who died and now lives. Here too you see an interesting play with Psalm 23. That who would imagine reading the psalm that my soul, my psuche, gets restored by him laying his down, him giving his up. So the connection of how that happens. Why is it that I can be safe in the valley of the death shadow? It's because he takes death upon himself. So it no longer is the wolf that can threaten me. I think everything that Professor Egger said about the provision, about us sort of wanting to do things on our own, would be equally suitable to preaching on this passage as well. Certainly, he's not the good shepherd only in the sense that he feeds us and takes care of us. But this is a table he sets before us that will be an everlasting banquet. Now here, of course, he doesn't, in this passage that we've read, say that this life that he takes up for himself will then be ours. But later in John's Gospel, he will make that clear. So his death means life for the sheep. The danger he faces means their security, and you see those exchanges going on. I think that should about cover both lessons then. Any questions? Okay. Well, thank you, and thank you for listening.